The particularly insidious part of this is they're only making that case for some people, right? There's this idea that assisted suicide is a right. No, it's not, because only certain people get this right. And so, again, assisted suicide is presented as a choice. But if you don't have a history of mental illness, if you don't have something that you could qualify as extremely painful, then it is still illegal for you to kill yourself. And it is still illegal for you to have a doctor assist you in killing yourselves. If you, however, struggle with mental illness, if you struggle with a disease, if you struggle with chronic pain, the government has pre-approved you to kill yourself. And so that right is accessible to you because the government has decided that your life is so, in fact, worthless, that not only are you allowed to kill yourselves, but they will facilitate and fund the procedure.
Hey everybody, Michael Thiessen here. You are listening to Open Mic with Michael Thiessen, and today I get to speak to Jonathan Van Maren. Jonathan, thanks so much for coming on. For our listeners, Jonathan is a public speaker, writer, activist. He's served for more than 10 years as communications director at the Canadian Center for Bioethical Reform. And you can read his bio online. It goes on and on. Jonathan, you've been published in some significant journals, and we're just excited to be talking today about these meaningful issues. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So as I gave you a heads up backstage, you know, I think you've been writing and researching about some important topics. And so I kind of will consider this podcast a bit of a hodgepodge unless we get into one specific area. But the most amount of interaction I've had with your work is the work, The Culture War. And I just want to, you know, thank you for that research. Out of that book on the sexual revolution, here's my question to get us started. How far do you think the sexual revolution will keep going if the church does not start being more prophetic towards culture in general? Like how, you know, we've gone from, you know, a certain type of legalized divorce. We've moved to redefinition of the family, and now we're seeing, you know, pride movements everywhere. How far do you think this is going?
It's a really tough question, because we know how far the sexual revolutionaries want to take it. We just don't know how successful they'll be. So I'll backtrack a little bit by pointing out that the reason the sexual revolution didn't progress farther than it did at the time was because of social conservatives and Christians, often women, pushing back. And so one of the things that your readers may be aware of is this whole debate in the States right now, talking about groomers, talking about drag queen story time, talking about the explicit sex education being offered to children. And one of the terms coined by some conservative activists has been referring to these people as groomers. And then there's been plenty of people pushing back and saying, no, this is not an accurate term. This is a slur and we shouldn't be using it. But the reality is that if you look at the founding sexual revolutionaries, from top to bottom, all of them very explicitly advocated for the sexualization of children and the sexualization of childhood. So if you go to Alfred Kinsey of the Kinsey Reports, his research involved facilitating pedophilic acts of sexual torture against children in order to compile data on so-called child sexuality, which was then used to make the case for sex education at younger and younger ages. You have an organization called the Pedophile Information Exchange operating openly in Great Britain well into the 1980s, being interviewed by the BBC, making their case in prominent newspapers, backed by certain members of the Young Liberal Party at the time, and endorsed openly twice by the Campaign for Homosexual Equality. This is a little bit of history that's been memory-holed. Same thing if you look at Michel Foucault, for example, who is kind of considered the father of wokeness and the inventor of critical theory. It was revealed last year, actually, that he was a pedophile rapist who raped a number of young boys while he was living in Tunisia, which should have come as no surprise, because along with Simone de Beauvoir and a number of other intellectuals, he signed an open letter defending somebody Who had been arrested and imprisoned for sex acts against a child, and basically made the case that the age of consent should be lowered. And it was because of a pushback by people like Phyllis Schlafly, by Mary Whitehouse, by the sort of the growing social conservative movement that involved pro-lifers, anti-porn activists, pro-marriage advocates, pro-family activists, that kind of stopped and halted the sexualization of children. But the key intellectuals and founders of the ideology that became the sexual revolution were very much in favor of the sexualization of children. Many of them were literal groomers in the actual physical sense. And so we know that that's where they want to go. Now, whether or not they will get there is of course the million-dollar question. And I have to say that I'm very encouraged by the pushback in the U.S. There's a very vibrant debate going on there right now. Even when it comes to a lot of the European countries on the issue of transgenderism, which has sort of exploded just over a handful of years, right? I wrote The Culture War in 2016, and I had a page on transgenderism then. It would be a chapter or two now. And this is only a couple of years later, right? But you have a lot of countries now second-guessing transition for children and some of the tenets of gender ideology. You have this happening in the UK, where their high court ruled that transgenderism should be kept away from children. You've got an open letter signed by 1,100 medical professionals and academics in France making the same case. The Scandinavians have been sounding the alarm on this. And of course, in the US, there's been a lot of public debate on it. So I wouldn't say that I'm optimistic, but I would say that I'm encouraged, if that makes sense.
It does make sense. And I'm glad that you answered the question behind the question in the sense of where are they planning to take it? Because of course, even as we get to this whole transgender movement, so much of this philosophical underpinnings of this movement is all the way back to Freud, who is obviously talking about the sexualization of the individual. And, I am sexually happy, therefore I am happy, you know, and pushing that on to the subconscious even. So as we are talking about these grand ideas of the sexual revolution, what you've just been traveling abroad and you've just been talking about these different movements going on. Mm-hmm. Where do you think the church can easily, maybe come out of the of their, cone of silence? Or I mean that the church proper, or maybe I mean that in the pastoral pulpits. Very many Christians, as you just mentioned, are leading the way in the voice of opposition. Are you seeing these things addressed in your travels from the pulpits? Are you seeing individuals getting their understanding of what they should be doing from the leadership of the churches, or is this kind of a parachurch movement?
Well, there's no way to do it easily. And that's because what we're actually seeing with the sexual revolution is that the tenets of the sexual revolution have replaced the Judeo-Christian values that society was based on. Our society was once organized around the natural family. We've redefined every term now, right? First, we redefined a preborn child was. We've redefined what marriage is. We've redefined what family is. Now we've redefined what man and woman are. Although nobody can say what a woman or a man actually is. There's no definition that people can give. And so because society is reorganizing itself around the principles of the sexual revolution rather than scriptural revelation, it is not easy to question the reigning dogma. And this is why even churches that still hold to a biblical understanding of humanity and family and sexuality are hesitant to speak out, because they don't want to attract fire, and they certainly will, right? Here in Canada, the only coverage that Christian organizations usually get is when the state broadcasters uncovered some new heresy. I remember, them going after Redeemer University because they were shocked and horrified to find out that a Christian college still adhered to Christian principles. And this is the sort of thing that happens pretty regularly, right? So most Christian institutions want to keep their head down, serve their people, and stay out of the cultural fray. And this is really really easy to understand. And then, of course, you have the spiritual Quislings, which is the mainline churches by and large, right? The Church of England announced recently that they don't actually know what a woman is either, that there is no set definition of what a woman is. And so what you see is a lot of the mainline churches, so the Anglican Church, the Episcopalian Church, the United Church in Canada, which is basically the NDP at prayer, these churches are part and parcel in lockstep behind the sexual revolution, pushing for its expansion. The United Church, helped push for the decriminalization of abortion here in Canada. And so those churches serve the function of allowing our leaders to say, see, they're the real Christians. And so the minority of Christians who still hold to a scriptural understanding of these things, they're just cruel. There's no reason that they need to hold to these beliefs, because we have all of these real Christians showing that you can be a Christian and you can be loving and compassionate at the same time. This is always directed at Christians, never Sikhs, Hindus, Muslims, or Orthodox Jews who hold very similar understandings of the issues in question here. And so it is difficult to speak out, because you're kind of getting clubbed from two sides. You're getting clubbed by the state, which has its new ideology, and then you're getting clubbed by their spiritual enforcers in a lot of the mainline Protestant denominations. Obviously, though, there is an opportunity with the sexual revolution that is unprecedented in the lifetimes of anybody who's listening, which is to say that in a culture seeking answers, we happen to possess a book that's full of them. And so we actually have answers on fundamental questions of identity and identity politics. There's a really phenomenal book that came out 2 years ago by Mary Aberstadt, who's probably one of the most talented researchers and scholars on the issue of the sexual revolution. And it's called Primal Screams: How the Sexual Revolution Produced Identity Politics. And she basically makes the case that the primal scream of our era is, who am I? And that's why people are clinging to these identities, because we're no longer born into tribes, you know, a mother, a father, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, brothers and sisters. So we no longer have natural tribes that we associate with that answered the question, who am I? And now you see, of course, us breaking into these faux tribes, whether it's the LGBT community, whatever that means, whether you're associating with your racial identity or any number of other communities that are sort of kind of fictitious and created in a lot of ways. And it's because we don't have the natural community that some of us were very blessed with. And so what we see is that a lot of people are asking the question, who am I? What am I doing here? Fundamental questions about what it means to be human, and Christianity has the answers to those questions. And so we do have a unique opportunity, as the post-Christian culture implodes, to ensure that it becomes a pre-Christian culture by raising our voices and offering up the answers that Christianity has always offered.
You've used a number of key phrases in there when we're talking about scriptural authority, and we're talking about like a biblically based church. So much of our conversation goes back to presupposing that God's word is absolutely authoritative and sufficient. Mm-hmm. And on this podcast, I regularly encourage our people to get back to walking by faith, and we have reason to follow up that faith, but not always trying to placate to the culture, another statistic, but calling the culture back to God and calling the culture back to God's word. Of course, in one of these big areas, the culture war is around abortion. And I know that you're passionate about this subject matter. Why don't we start with the overthrow of Roe v. Wade just happening recently, mm-hmm. and with all of the conversations, like the new Matt Walsh, what is a woman out there? Hmm. Why don't we just start with defining a child, a preborn child? So many of our listeners are kind of looking for wisdom on how to navigate this conversation. Obviously, in the same way that the left and the woke ideologues don't want to name what is a woman or what is a man, even while they talk absurdity, they certainly don't want to define a child. So, Jonathan, can we start back and talk about defining a child? And then can you unpack a little bit of the pro-life movement? It sounds like you're involved all around the world, and maybe our people need to hear a little bit of hope about the movement itself and how robust it seems to be, flexing its muscles right now.
Well, defining a child is pretty simple, because these definitions are all science. And now if you're a Christian, you don't believe there's two versions of truth. There's no such thing as secular truth. All truth is God's truth. So when you're presenting the science of when a human life begins and what a human being looks like in the womb, you're presenting truth that is fundamentally from God. Now, we know if you go to if people want a handy resource, go to ehd.org. Very easy to remember. It's the Endowment for Human Development, and it shows you videos of children in the womb at each stage, right? And a child fundamentally is just offspring of two human parents. And so then the question is, when does that human life begin? And this is where the abortion activists are trying to really cloud things, because if you can kind of make it murky as to when human life begins, then of course you can excuse aborting that life at the stage in which you have caused the murk. But the arguments that we use most frequently on the streets in Canada, and we see people change their minds on this issue every day, is human beings have human rights. Human rights begin when the human being begins. Science tells us when a human being begins. And as such, abortion is not a human right. It's a human rights violation because it ends that life. Now, interestingly, everybody instinctively knows that the baby in the womb is a baby, because when we're not talking about abortion, everybody knows what we're talking about. Right. If somebody says they're expecting, pro-choice people don't ask them what they're expecting. When they ask, how many weeks along are you? They're fundamentally admitting when life begins. How many weeks along from what? Oh, I'm at 12 weeks. 12 weeks from what? Right. The very language they themselves use indicate that they instinctively, if not intellectually, understand when a human life begins. It informs all of our discussions around children and pregnancy, but they become mysteriously amnesiac when it comes to the question of abortion. And you can, if you engage somebody in a conversation just about pregnancy or about childbearing, you'll notice that they have no question in their mind about any of these fundamental issues. Introduce abortion to the question, and suddenly, you'll be getting all of these very philosophical questions that defy the instinctive knowledge that they were previously displaying.
I really like it how you went back to the, how far along are you from what? And it's so true that instinctively and intellectually people can be intellectually dishonest, even though their instinct is screaming to you. Like I remember just a few weeks ago when Justin Trudeau made an announcement about blood donations, men who are having sex with men. Mm-hmm. And immediately you wanted to say, well, he's using the term men as if it's definable, understandable, it can be qualified. But then, if you were in that room as a journalist and you put up your hand and you said, well, what is a man? He would immediately start trying to backtrack from just his normal common vernacular. Mm-hmm. Okay, so can you move on then, Jonathan, to tell us like what's been going on in the pro-life movement? I know that's a big question. Feel free to highlight what you want, but I think sometimes our listeners here in Canada feel, and in the US, can feel quite isolated from the rest of the world. And I know you've been traveling recently and already made references internationally. Like, you're seeing good things. How has the movement been developing?
Well, I think it's just important to understand that in every country where abortion was legalized, in almost every country, I should say, a movement to combat abortion rose up in response by people committed to saving lives and to rescuing people and helping women wherever they could. So I was just recently in the Netherlands, where I was speaking at a conference, and abortion was one of the subjects I was talking about. There's a lot of great pro-life groups in the Netherlands. One of them, the English name for it would be We Cry for Life, which does great work. There's a Catholic group also named Sterezo. I've worked extensively with an organization called Pro-Life Europe, which is based out of Vienna, but has a student group set up in a dozen countries that seek to just basically make an impact on those around them. The young people of today who work in the pro-life movements were born and raised in countries where abortion was the accepted status quo. And so I think the older generation often doesn't realize the extent to which a lot of young people who are pro-choice is not something they thought through. They weren't pro-life, rejected that, became pro-choice. They didn't have to be persuaded by university professors or philosophers. The culture that they were born into is post-sexual revolution. There are very few people left alive who remember what life was like before the sexual revolution. And as such, they're speaking into a culture that is often stunned to hear their message and not at all familiar with it. And so that, again, provides challenges and opportunities, because it does mean that that a lot of young people aren't attached and committed to the pro-choice ideology in the way that those who fought to make abortion legal were and are. In some cases, are. In fact, in Canada, if you look at the data, the people least likely to change their minds when confronted with the truth about abortion are women over 50. And it's because they're part of the generation that fought the battle to legalize abortion in the first place. And so I would say that there's a lot of interesting things going on all around the world. There was just a huge rally for life in Ireland, which of course legalized abortion by referendum in 2018. I wrote a book on that afterwards, taking a look at the history of the Irish pro-life movement. But I would say that the most invigorating thing for everybody who works in the pro-life movement around the world is the fall of Roe v. Wade. The fall of Roe v. Wade, I think, is far more significant than a lot of people realize, simply because it's the first time where something that was done has been undone. Something that was chosen has been unchosen. Something that was decided was undecided. After almost 50 years, almost a full half century, after abortion was declared a constitutional right, the highest court in the world's most powerful democracy said it is no longer considered a constitutional right. It's really staggering when you think about the implications of it for that reason. And it sort of breathed life into pro-life activists around the world who can now hold out hope that if it's possible in America, perhaps it's possible elsewhere too. It took the pro-life movement 50 years, but they did in fact accomplish the goal of toppling this horrific and unjust decision. And so you've got left-wing newspapers like The Guardian, who are publishing articles talking about the horrifying implications of this, is that pro-lifers are emboldened around the world, but also governments that were pushing to legalize abortion and were considering, for example, loosening restrictions in places in Africa or South or Latin America are now pausing, because America is the nation that many people look to as a cultural influencer. And the message they have just sent out is a tremendously powerful and hopeful one.
Yeah, that decision, I've read a bunch of the decision and listened to a bunch of the decision and the concurrences and the dissent. And I think you're absolutely right that there was a willingness to go back and legally deal with the Constitution as written. And they say within the decision that it's their responsibility to undo a previous decision. Like it's a responsibility that even though this was already here, to go back and undo something if that first decision was erroneous. And so I think I couldn't agree with you more. So now that more people are dialoguing about the pro-life movement, of course, it seems pretty self-evident that there will be either fractions in the movement or more nuances of the movement. So fractions in the negative aspect of some form of division, nuance is in not so much a negative form. You know, here within the Canadian freedom movement, you know, you would have nuances where people are trying to help people understand the difference between license and liberty, and helping people understand the difference between totalitarianism and healthy government and all of those types of things. And then there'd be the fraction side of things where, you know, people would be out there calling us nationalists, and what conjures up in somebody's mind there is, you know, somebody who is actually quite utilitarian, or you've got nationalist in the sense of just someone who thinks of putting Canada first for Canadians rather than, you know, placating to a globalist agenda. So within the pro-life movement now, I've been hearing two different terms quite recently that people have been throwing around and trying to define. And Jonathan, I'd like you to help our listeners understand all of that. So we've got the term incrementalist, and then we've got the term abolitionist. And so these are two terms I'm hearing people speak about. Can you kind of, with your understanding of the entire movement and the broader movement, give us an understanding of these two terms, kind of where you land, and help our people understand what people are saying when they use these terms?
Well, I don't think they're particularly helpful terms for understanding the pro-life movement. I should say that pro-life movements is probably a more accurate way to characterize it. And so the debates around the most effective way to save the most number of babies with the best piece of legislation date all the way back to the legalization of abortion, right? There's always been these different organizations with different governing philosophies and different strategies, right? You had Personhood USA, which basically was pushing to have preborn children fundamentally recognized as persons under the U.S. Constitution. The Human Life Amendment back in the 1980s kind of failed by the mid-1980s, but that was a one-pronged strategy. The incrementalist abolitionist distinction was primarily a debate that happened, it was 5 or 6 years ago now, primarily, where an organization of people took the term abolitionist, which of course refers to those who fought to end the slave trade and slavery itself in the U.S. and the U.K. and elsewhere, and tried to distinguish themselves from the pro-life movement proper. But again, the pro-life movement is so complex, so filled with a wide variety of different individuals, different strategies, even different worldviews and beliefs fundamentally, that these terms don't actually serve to enlighten those hearing them. And they were basically making the case that any incremental move towards abolishing abortion was fundamentally unjust, that states should defy Roe v. Wade and move to abolish abortion completely. Of course, that whole debate is sort of a moot point now because Roe v. Wade has been overturned. And so I'm not sure those distinctions actually post-Roe mean much. Now, there is going to be a lot of debates about what kinds of laws should be passed now. And it's a tough political discussion to have because obviously equal justice needs to be established for all human beings. Abortion should be illegal. It should be banned because the intentional destruction, the murder of another human being should never be permissible under law. But there are states where the majority is pro-choice. And so you'll have politicians attempting to figure out what law could we pass that we could hold on to. Right. What law could we pass that wouldn't result in all of us getting, you know, chucked out at the next election and promptly reversed? And so those are some difficult discussions that are unfolding now. You've got states with healthy pro-life majorities that can ban abortion outright. But then you do also have to be careful in crafting the laws because, of course, the question of penalty is a very difficult one, considering the privacy of abortion, the nature of coercion and how it intersects with all these different things. And so one of the reasons that terms like abolitionist are being used a lot more right now is the mainstream media is delighted by the position of some of the abolitionists that that women should be imprisoned for having an abortion, because what the media wants to discuss right now is not abortion. Because, of course, when we discuss abortion, they lose. What they want to discuss is women being unable to get treatment for miscarriage. They want to claim that abortion laws will fundamentally result in women dying for lack of medical treatment, which is obviously not the case. And they want to make the case that what pro-lifers actually want to do and have always wanted to do is to control sexuality and lock women up, right? They want to have a discussion about a 17-year-old coerced into taking the abortion pill, landing behind bars for 20 years. Those are the discussions they want to have. And so those who are most vociferously talking about whether or not we should imprison women, of course, are going to find themselves getting a lot of attention from the media right now, not because their case is compelling, in my view, but simply because they serve the media's purpose right now in establishing a narrative that does not discuss abortion, but discusses corollary issues.
So is this a dialogue of inner camp strategy debate, or are these labels that are just outright kind of media labels thrown on? Like, so basically, the definition, Jonathan, that you just gave, I would assume when you say all abortion should be illegal because all life needs to be protected, that throws you philosophically or fundamentally into an abolitionist's realm, in the sense of like you would like to work to the abolishment of abortion. But that doesn't necessarily probably represent you how the conversation is going, where you're trying to now talk about tactics and those types of things. So is it inner camp debate on strategy, or is it just outer media, like you just said, trying to inflame the discussion so we're not actually talking about abortion?
Yeah, the reason I wouldn't agree with saying that my position reflects abolitionist sentiment is just because I think it's been the pro-life sentiment all along, and the abolitionists have tried to create a false distinction. And it's not a distinction that I think exists. You're going to find plenty of people in the pro-life movement that I disagree with, and disagree with very, very strongly. And we have inner camp debates, as you put it. The abolitionists as a group of people would say that they're not part of the pro-life movement. They would be insulted by the accusation and would say that they're a very separate thing. And so they, by definition, are sort of having a dialogue with themselves and not having a dialogue with the pro-life movement because they're sort of separate from it. And
is
one
it
of the
like
reasons,
the difference between the way we would typically feel about, like, you know, someone saying I'm a Reformed Baptist and then someone being like, ooh, I'm a little bit better than you in the Reformed Baptist camp. I'm an independent Reformed Baptist. Like, I think that's probably a decent analogy. Okay. Because the reason why I want to dig on this a little bit is because I feel like these terms get people throwing stones at each other. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden you're just like, wait a minute, for example, Samuel Say just tweeted out something about this recently. And so mm-hmm. people are talking about it and I'm going, well, wait a minute, I'm a pro-lifer. Like, I've always wanted to end abortion and willing to work with people to do so. I'm confused by now the label I'm being given. And now all of a sudden it seems like our camp is divided, where you're saying, okay, where I think you're saying, and feel free to clarify it, is like, okay, we've got some denominational distinctions over here, but there's a rare few who are sitting over here who really like to view themselves independently of everybody else, almost like salvation only within their denomination. Mm-hmm. That seems to be what you're describing.
Yeah, that's a good analogy. Okay. I would say that's accurate. Yep, it's actually the best analogy I've heard so far. I think that does very much reflect. Like, they were very there was no rejoicing in their camp when Roe v. Wade overturned, for example. While everybody was celebrating the fall of Roe v. Wade, they just said, well, everybody should have been ignoring this all along, and so you shouldn't be celebrating. Instead, you should repent for not having defied the Supreme Court before, sort of thing, right? Like, it was abortion activists and abolitionists who didn't have a good day when Roe v. Wade went down.
Okay, so then let's just go to the opposite side, just to make clear about the term about incrementalism. Mm-hmm. Then we're really talking mm-hmm. about the fact that most of the people who may identify themselves as incrementalists mm-hmm. are still fundamentally, theologically, philosophically trying to bring an end to all abortion, but working within a system that has been so pro-choice for so long that they're going to celebrate victory when you see it. So, for example, when Roe v. Wade is overturned, and now you still have the authority just going down to the state level, mm-hmm. you know, and like you just said earlier, we're talking about this again in a world where people were just assuming it to be a right. Those are two like great achievements. And the incrementalist is going to go, yeah, like, I'm incrementally happy and still pushing towards the ending of all abortions, if at all possible.
Yeah, well, like, I think it's analogous to when the Emancipation Proclamation was declared by Abraham Lincoln, right? It only freed the slaves in the rebelling states at that point, and as such was not a complete victory, and yet the church bells rang all over D.C. and elsewhere when the abolitionists of that time, who knew how to celebrate incremental gains, heard the news. The same thing would be true when William Wilberforce found that his Slave Trade Act finally passed in 1807. Slavery itself wasn't banned on the British Empire until 1833. And yet he, you know, sank down into his seat in Parliament and wept tears of joy to hear the news. And so abolitionists specifically themselves have a history of celebrating incremental wins, even though they haven't brought them all the way there yet. And so I would say that the fall of Roe v. Wade is analogous to 1955. The Brown v. Board of Education. It's analogous to the 1807 Slave Trade Act. It's analogous to the Emancipation Proclamation of Abraham Lincoln.
Those are great illustrations, and I too, like, I'm just so excited about. I was actually privileged to be in Kentucky on the day that that the Supreme Court judgment was read. And I just,
Very cool.
I think I've shared this on the podcast previously, just in the last few weeks. So my wife and I happened to be in China adopting our fourth child when China issued that the one child rule was no longer in place. And we actually one of our adoption agency workers was reading the newspaper and responding. And I can't remember whether it was positive or negative, but I said, "What are you reading?" They said, the one child policy has now just been overthrown. And then I was in Kentucky for Roe v. Wade. So I was just excited to be in
very there. Neat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, John, then thank you for clarifying that, because I don't want now that this is a popular discussion, and it's, I think for a culture war, it couldn't be better as far as now we're actually getting to talk about it. But I was really concerned where I just started listening to different Christians immediately. I'm going to be interviewing Abby Johnson later today and talking to her. And some Christians immediately responded with, well, she's an incrementalist, or, she's not an abolitionist. And I was like, okay, I'm going to need to dig into those two terms. So thanks for clearing that up.
And some of those discussions too is obviously, like any movement with stakes as high as there is, there's interpersonal conflict. That means that there are pro-life leaders who don't like other pro-life leaders. And there's plenty of that too. My general policy is that I don't criticize in public. And that these fights are family feuds. And as such, you don't air them out, because only the pro-abortion side wins when these discussions are taking place, on Facebook or on podcasts and things like that. With the abolitionists, they say that they are specifically not a part of the pro-life movement. And so I will critique them. But you'll notice I keep it as generic as possible with regards to the personalities involved.
No, and that's wise. Mm-hmm. It's actually been one of the hardest parts of the entire COVID-19 pandemic, where there was very little, at least in our Baptist circles, there was little private theological discourse and very much a public opposition of one another. I would say that you start going back and forth, and you try to have a conversation in front of a whole bunch of people where you're not looking each other face to face. It very rarely goes well. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. So one of the areas of research that you also get into is the area of suicide. And I've just lectured at the Ezra Institute recently, just about doctor assisted suicide. And I thought maybe I'd ask you this because you've dug into it a bit. As you wrote your book about, giving advice to people to talk about suicide, what do you think is the difference between talking about suicide and talking about doctor-assisted suicide? And then specifically then the question behind that is, what's the difference between someone contemplating suicide or someone committing suicide in a society, and then the difference between that and a society allowing for doctor-assisted suicide? They seem to be very different topics, but on the surface, they can come across to people, kind of be confused about that.
Yeah. So the book that you're referring to is one I co-authored with my colleague, Blaise Lane. We spent a bunch of time having discussions on assisted suicide to find out which arguments could persuade people who didn't have a religious or scriptural foundation that assisted suicide was a tragedy, that it was wrong, and that it should not be tolerated. And it's interesting that you frame the question the way that you do, because fundamentally the conclusion we reached is that there shouldn't be a difference between the way we talk about suicide and physician-assisted suicide. Now, we just discussed the abortion debate, and what's very important for us to do when we're looking at how the brilliant rhetoricians and polemicists on the other side frame their argument is to look at which terms they don't want to discuss. Right. So the abortion activists don't want to discuss abortion. That's why they call themselves pro-choice. That's why post-Roe, they don't want to discuss abortion. What they want to discuss is whether or not women will face penalties for having them. They want to discuss, whether or not women will be able to get treatment for miscarriages. Right. They want to discuss anything but abortion. And we shouldn't give them the opportunity to divert the discussion to something else, to corollary issues. We should focus on the issue at hand, which is that abortion is the murder of a human being. Now, with assisted suicide, the word that they don't want anybody to talk about is the term suicide. Now, in Canada, I don't know if you remember this, but I remember the month it happened is when the Carter case came down from the Canadian Supreme Court, where the Canadian Supreme Court informed Parliament that they had a duty to legislate for assisted suicide. That's what we were talking about at the time, is we were talking about assisted suicide. And then the term changed. We were talking about doctor-assisted suicide, right? Let's tack a doctor on the front. Seems far less sinister. Everybody trusts their doctors. Then, however, the word suicide vanished entirely, and we were talking about medical aid in dying, which got shortened to MAID. You will not find any newspaper or mainstream outlet from the state broadcaster to the major city broadsheets that are referring to assisted suicide as assisted suicide. They only will discuss MAID. And it's really interesting because I still remember when the flip happened. I would love to see the emails and the directives that, you know, went from Death with Dignity to the various editorial rooms, which then ended up framing the entire discussion. And it's because nobody wanted to use the word suicide, and people realized very quickly that no matter whether or not you talk about assisted suicide or physician assisted suicide or doctor assisted suicide, you were never going to make the term suicide warm and fuzzy for anyone. Because at the end of the day, everybody knows somebody who has struggled with suicidal ideation. Many people know someone who has attempted suicide. Some of us know people who successfully committed suicide. And the word is just too tied up in tragedy and horror and grief and sadness to ever be something that people will look upon as a positive right. And so,
Jonathan, can I pause you there just for one second, just so that people don't miss what you just said there? Like, experientially, suicide is a painful word because it's so painful. It's a process by which someone terminates their life, ends their life early. And those who have been surrounded by that all see the tragedy in that decision. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to interrupt your thought, your train of thought, but I also just didn't want to skim over that. So what they're trying to do is get you to think anything but the reality that people are commonly experiencing.
Because fundamentally, physician-assisted suicide is suicide, but somebody helps you. And so they changed the terminology. And it's really interesting because in our book, we wrote that, look, the reason they're trying to stop the discussion around suicide and shift it to around MAID is because they know it's easier to sell to people that way. And then I gave a talk on this in the Netherlands last week. And what I ended up finding was an article that came out from a philosopher ethicist, which means, you know, he's going to say some truly crazy things. And he actually explicitly stated there are still places that refer to assisted suicide as assisted suicide. This is a problem. We need to call it MAID because people won't get on board with it. So a couple of years after we wrote the book in which we stated that, they started saying the quiet part out loud and are now openly admitting we can't use the term suicide because it's very difficult to sell suicide as a positive right to a population that recognizes it as a tragedy.
Hey, everybody, just like talking to Jonathan about the MAID program in our country and assisted suicide, let's face it, the economic prospects in our country also appear bleak. With inflation at 40-year highs and a government that does not understand fiscal responsibility, who can you trust to protect your financial future? I want you to give my friends at RockLink Investment Partners a call. You know, I'm going to be talking to them about our own finances in the next few weeks as we've seen a change between the US and Canadian dollar. These guys don't follow the crowd. They think independently and invest prudently to protect your wealth from those who seek to destroy it. So give them a call at 905-631-5462 and send them an email at info@rocklink.com. That's rocklink with a C.com. Link is spelled LINC. Okay, everybody, thanks for listening again. And let's go over to these good sponsors. So, when one of the things that I was talking about recently with students was that one of the differences when we're looking at even just the basic ideas, like an individual taking their own life versus now the law protecting individuals who would assist, is all the motivation all the commercialization now of the act, where if someone tragically took their own life and that was illegal in order to make a moral statement. But now in the fact that you have this assisted suicide, not only are you making a moral statement about just the act itself as an individual, but you're opening up this whole business, this whole new pressure for an individual who might be contemplating suicide to now follow through with their act while others benefit. Can you talk – are you guys in your research, did you come across the actual – like I almost wanted to ask you, like, did you come across, you know, how much does an individual make when they help someone else die, or when they convince a family member to terminate someone else's life, and that an individual does? Like, there is a business in this, I would assume.
In other places, yes. In places like Switzerland and Canada, of course, everything is covered by public health, right? So the government.
Okay, so then it's still in public's health interest to push it, because then public health, the public health system benefits financially.
The state broadcaster, the CBC, literally published an article during the discussion in 2015 surrounding this issue, explaining how much money we were going to save by offing terminally ill people. There's like 30% palliative care capacity right now. There are people literally opting to kill themselves or have themselves killed because they cannot get the palliative care they desire or were promised, because they cannot get the appropriate assistance for the disability that they have. This is actually happening. And what I think I want to hark back just to something you said, when you said like the government's making a moral statement about suicide. The particularly insidious part of this is they're only making that case for some people, right? There's this idea that assisted suicide is a right. No, it's not, because only certain people get this right. And so again, assisted suicide is presented as a choice. But if you don't have a history of mental illness, if you don't have something that you could qualify as extremely painful, then it is still illegal for you to kill yourself. And it is still illegal for you to have a doctor assist you in killing yourselves. If you, however, struggle with mental illness, if you struggle with a disease, if you struggle with chronic pain, the government has pre-approved you to kill yourself. And so that right is accessible to you because the government has decided that your life is so, in fact, worthless, that not only are you allowed to kill yourselves, but they will facilitate and fund the procedure. If you do not, however, suffer from these mental or physical afflictions, the government has decided that your life is so valuable that you get assisted suicide prevention rather than suicide assistance. So again, you have this illusion of choice, this idea that assisted suicide is a right that you can choose now. No, it's not. It's a choice that the government has decided to give some people, because again, they've decided that those people are pre-approved to kill themselves due to the worth of their lives. Now imagine what kind of message that sends to somebody struggling with depression or suicidal ideation. Imagine the message that sends to somebody who's wondering whether or not he's a burden for his family or her family, right? The government has already told them, by legalizing suicide for them, what they think of the worth and the value of that life. And so we need to really expose this insidious pile of garbage. This is somehow about choice rather than pre-approving people the state has decided are so worthless that they'll actually assist them in killing themselves and hurry them along and making the choice.
What do you advise the next generation of young adults who are listening today when we're talking about all of these topics? It seems so overwhelming. You know, I'm sure every the end of every one of your PowerPoints, at the end of one of your presentations, I'm sure you've got some application for individuals. And it's partly because I'm asking that right now, partly because in each one of these topic areas that we're discussing, it's like there's volumes of work to be done. So what are you sending people out to do?
Well, the reason Blaise and I wrote a guide to discussing assisted suicide is so that people would discuss assisted suicide, right? The Canadian government is what it is. In all likelihood, the next leader of the Conservative Party will be supportive of assisted suicide, supportive of abortion, supportive of gender ideology and conversion therapy bans and the whole works. So there's no political solution forthcoming, which means that we need to do what Christians have always done, which is engage our peers in discussion to know how to defend our position in terms and using language that our opponents understand, and to attack the lies they use to comfort themselves the most, which is why when it comes to discussing assisted suicide, for example, always use the word suicide, highlight the fact that it is suicide, and attack the illusion that it is in fact a choice. Find out which arguments that they comfort themselves with and use to defend this, and then tear them apart using language that they can understand. And so that's what I think that we need to do now. We live in a post-Christian culture, which means that we need to be making the case. We need to be explaining that the things that progressives like to defend fail on their own terms, right? They're very often the very opposite of what is being claimed, right? Suicide is not a choice. The government has decided who gets to do it and who does not get to do it. Abortion is not a human right. It's a human rights violation. Right. So we need to be able to turn their arguments on their head and compassionately and effectively make the case.
When we talk about suicide, can you do that for my listeners right now? Just tear it apart a little bit. So, you know, you've got the average individual out there going, well, look, if someone is suffering enough, it would make sense that the most compassionate thing to do is to end the life. And, you know, we're going to put up our hand and we're going to quote Psalm 90 and we're going to quote other scriptures that would talk about, you know, the individual being in the hands of the Lord, and that any death premature to a natural death outside of, you know, God's sovereign decision making is going to be premature and therefore, you know, against his will. First of all, I think that's where we ought to go. That my personal opinion is, again, to bring the Lord back into these conversations, to not shrink away from Scripture, to not shrink away from the fact that we're living by faith, living out our worldview because we trust God and His Word and whatnot. Moving from that discussion of trying to win people back to the, you know, being created in the image of God and being in the hands of God. One of the areas I quickly go to is just how easily motivated the entire, you know, you just mentioned how Canada is deeply invested. Like the government, the government has a vested interest in pushing these things through. Mm-hmm. What are some of the other areas where you go into to just kind of tearing apart that whole, isn't it the most compassionate thing?
Well, I just want to send the listeners over to the website Care Not Kill, which was produced by the Association for Reformed Political Action, using a lot of the arguments that Blaise and I laid out in the book. Go and check that out, because it actually gives you a step-by-step on how to discuss it. The argument that I find most effective is twofold. One is the one I just discussed, which is highlighting the illusion of choice. The second one is using what I would not call the slippery slope fallacy, but pointing out the inevitable consequences of establishing suicide for those with mental illness, for those who are suffering from pain. Essentially, we're legalizing suicide for those who have suicidal ideation. And one of the questions that I just like to ask people to get them thinking is there anybody in your life who has experienced suicidal ideation that might have used this law if it had been available at the time? And again, it refocuses it on suicide, but also in their mind, people will run through the list of those that they love very dearly and enrich their lives so much and bless them in so many ways, and what might happen if those people were not around. And so point out that assisted suicide is not a policy. It's about actual people and what would our lives be like without them. And how cruel it is to offer suicide to the suicidal, right? You mentioned the Psalms. The phrase I always think of when I think about the mercy killing argument is that the tender mercies of the wicked are cruel. And nothing I think highlights that quite as much as our assisted suicide regime.
That's going to become especially important when we see the definition of or the permissions for assisted suicide to be broadened, right? I think it's March 2023 when MAID is supposed to be broadened to now just have a qualification of mental illness. Have you guys been tracking that a little bit, that broadening and what you suspect will then be allowed as far as just, you know, I've got a 16-year-old who's had a bad day at school and really wants to just end it all and that be covered. Do you think we're going to get to that level of seeing the worthlessness of the human being in order for the state to get to make to profit off of ending someone's life?
I don't think it's unlikely. The law that was produced, it's hard not to attribute malice to the Liberal government in passing this policy for a couple of reasons. First of all, almost every disability rights group spoke up against this. These are not, you know, churches. These are not the sort of, you know, usual Christian suspects that would find themselves ignored anyways. You know, these are groups that begged the government to reconsider this. A lot of groups that involve themselves with mental health are the same thing. None of their recommendations were pursued. Second of all, this was done when palliative care is still available to a tiny minority of the population. None of that was addressed. Even Aaron O'Toole, the former leader of the Conservative Party, who didn't possess any convictions that one could see with the naked eye, thought that this bill was extremely dangerous and voted against it. And some of the provisions in the bill, right, like it'll allow for same-day euthanasia. You can request and receive assisted suicide inside of a single day. This just turns everything we know about depression, suicidal ideation, mental illness directly on its head. It's just staggering to consider it. So the resoluteness.
Jonathan, can you unpack that just a little bit for our listeners? Someone who's struggling with these thoughts, is time often a factor to help them get through it? Like, just kind of unpack that.
It's almost always a factor, right? Because mental illness, because we live, you know, in the 2020s, there's increasingly like amazing cures and amazing therapies, and we understand so much more than we used to. I heard a lecture from a psychiatrist who said now that when he deals with a lot of patients with depression, and he says, "I'm never done trying something new. There's always something else that I can offer them," right? That's of course somebody who's committed to that patient's life and that patient's well-being. But that's not, of course, the case with a doctor who specializes in suicide. But what we're going to see is people who are suffering from depression, who end up going and applying for assisted suicide, and it will be done effectively. Keep in mind too that the data we have on those who, after they attempt suicide, are overwhelmed with gratitude that they failed. We have data on people, for example, who jump from bridges, etc. And almost all of them report feeling instant regret the moment they've jumped, which lends an extra a tragedy to those who successfully commit suicide, because we know that many of them likely wish they hadn't done it the moment they had. That is not, of course, you don't get a second go around when it's a doctor knocking you with barbiturates and then giving you a lethal injection. Those suicides will always be effective. And that's what we're going to see in Canada. Like, we already know what's going to happen, right? We know that people with mental illness are going to kill themselves with the help of a doctor. We know people suffering from depression are going to kill themselves with the help of a doctor. We know that there are families who are going to come out and say, we couldn't stop our mother, our sister, our wife, our friend from pursuing this. But they did it anyways. We already have a lawsuit being launched in British Columbia by the daughters of a woman who applied for and successfully received assisted suicide and were just absolutely heartbroken that she didn't get the treatment she needed, but was instead killed. I think this is going to be the tragedy with a thousand faces. I think we're going to be seeing stories like that with great regularity. And unfortunately, it's very hard to put the toothpaste back in the tube. And our courts, which are the courts are, of course, the body that imposed this on us to begin with, are going to continue probably to expand that right. There's very little reason for optimism on this particular file.
Well, one of the things that we all need to do is, again, return to scripture, really get passionate about articulating our views. Jonathan, I thank you for being such a role model for research and for open dialogue. I remember hearing you lecture early on when you had just released a Culture Wars book, and I appreciated it greatly. Keep up the good work. Any most recent websites or places you want to send our listeners to? So you've already mentioned the ARPA website, and we brought it up just last week. Can you go over that ARPA website again and then give us any information that our listeners need to hear about you?
That's Care Not Kill, Go check that out. My website is thebridgehead.ca. You can buy my books there. I post daily columns and culture updates there. So check that out if you feel so inclined.
That's awesome. Well, hey, blessings to you and your family, and thank you for coming on, everybody. Mm-hmm. Thanks for listening today, and make sure that you share this podcast out. We've got so many Christians that need to understand that we are in a culture war, that our worldview is needed for our society, both in the eternal salvation as we preach repentance of sin, but also just in order for our society to flourish and not just completely move into chaos. We need to preach that type of salvation to our world, again, through repentance and through calling people back to scripture. But so share this out, because Jonathan's got an incredible amount of resources. You can see the research is on our side. Go and share this podcast out so other people are willing to talk openly about being pro-life and openly about being pro-life at the end stages as well. So Jonathan, thanks for coming on, and everyone, thanks for listening. Godspeed.